Welcome to the Free the Economy podcast. I'm your host, Richard Morrison. I'm a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., and this is episode 73 for May 16th, 2024. Free the Economy is about how we can all become happier, healthier, and wealthier in a world with less government control. We believe in a voluntary society where consent, rather than force, governs human interactions. And while the economy we have now offers many opportunities for financial success and self-fulfillment, we know that we can do even better. Reminder, you can always find our show notes with links to the stories we cover at the Competitive Enterprise Institute blog at cei.org/blog. If you like the show, please leave us a review and follow us on Twitter at @free_the_economy. Now we're going to start by covering some recent headlines and events that you should know about, and then go on to our interview with Claire Kittle Dixon, Executive Director of the nonprofit recruiting and staffing agency, Talent Market. We'll talk about finding the right job when you're looking, choosing the right person when you're hiring, making a career in the nonprofit world, and leaving corporate America to follow your passion. My old friend Dan Rothschild of the Mercatus Center at George Mason University has a great review out of the new book, The War on Prices, edited by Cato Institute's Ryan Bourne. As Dan points out, many politicians and the voters they pander to seem to think that the primary goal of government should be to protect favored industries, classes, and interest groups from the predations of market prices. The U.S. economy is subject to a dizzying array of taxes, subsidies, floors, ceilings, prohibitions, requirements, and threats from the government, intending at lowering the final retail prices of everything from eggs and electric vehicles to childcare and monthly rent payments. But the mentality that produced all of those interventions ignores the fact that prices are not arbitrary instruments of avarice set unilaterally by capitalists. They're valuable market signals that contain information about human desires and preferences. We ignore and distort them at our peril. The book clarifies confusion about the real causes and even definition of inflation, among other topics, but does so, according to Dan, with a gentlemanly virtue. He writes, quote, "It's a great credit both to Bourne as editor and the contributors he recruited that they avoid temptation to mock and belittle arguments they oppose, as easy in some cases as it would be. Rather, they steel man and address the best possible versions of the arguments they reject. Such intellectual honesty has fallen out of fashion in many circles, and Bourne et al. Equipped themselves well in bucking the temptation to simply label and dismiss opponents. Such an approach would likely sell more books, but readers would be the poorer for it," end quote. With contributors like Stan Vuger, Jeffrey Marin, Eamon Butler, Dieter McCloskey, and our own episode 65 guest, Peter Jaworski, as contributors, the book has a lot to recommend it. You can get a copy for yourself at Amazon and wherever else you buy books under the title The War on Prices, How Popular Misconceptions About Inflation, Prices, and Value Create Bad Policy. According to Emily Stewart at Business Insider, corporate America went woke in recent years, but is now having second thoughts. Stewart reports on the politically fashionable embrace of left-wing political causes by corporate management at high-profile companies like Unilever, and how previous commitments are getting rolled back in an era of higher interest rates, tighter competition, and public backlash from normie consumers. She calls this the Great Unwokening. She writes, quote, "Over the past decade, many corporations have professed to take a more active role in social issues under pressure from their customers and, more importantly, employees. Companies pushed back on North Carolina's bathroom bill in 2016, and when Donald Trump took the White House, many spoke out against his policies on immigration and the environment. Around the time, the Business Roundtable said it was time to rethink the purpose of a company, and BlackRock's Larry Fink expressed all sorts of thoughts about the importance of companies being responsible social stewards," end quote. And of course, in the summer of 2020, many companies issued public statements about the death of George Floyd and support for the Black Lives Matter movement, which was leading protests and demonstrations across the country and inspiring them all over the world. But then came the backlash. Many investors started asking why widely held companies were taking positions on controversial political topics that were in opposition to a significant portion of the public and their own customers. How was any of that helping the bottom line? What did it have to do with corporate mission? The enthusiasm for environmental, social, and governance, or ESG investing, also began to fade as ESG-aligned investments failed to outperform the market, as implied and in some cases promised. According to Morningstar, investors pulled $13 billion out of sustainable funds in 2023 amid underperformance and political unease. Plenty of critics also objected to the diversity strategies employed as part of the push for ESG. The so-called DEI policies were invasive and unpopular and possibly even illegal under the Civil Rights Act of 1964. In a 2023 Conference Board survey of more than 100 large U.S. companies, almost half of respondents said they'd gotten some ESG backlash, and nearly two-thirds said they expected the problem to persist or get worse over the next 2 years. Now that the opportunities for virtue-signaling corporate activism are shriveling up, executives at major firms may have to actually turn their attention back to making products and services that customers want to buy. I wish them luck in this exotic new adventure. You all should know that Congress is poised on the verge of destroying your credit card rewards, the points and miles that you can use for discounts and unpriced travel. We talked about this at length in episode 36 with Brian Beshear of Americans for Tax Reform, and now our episode 11 guest, Patrice Onwuka of the Independent Women's Forum, has a new op-ed on the Durbin-Marshall Credit Card Competition Act, or CCCA. The bill authors believe that credit card swipe fees, the added fees for using a credit card to make purchases, are, quote, a part of the problem when it comes to high inflation. It's highly questionable whether there's any real connection there, but the bill would require large credit card issuing banks to enable at least two credit card networks to process their transactions instead of just one, and at least one of those networks would have to be not Visa or MasterCard. The bill's supporters believe that increasing competition in processing card transactions would reduce credit card processing fees. Those savings are supposed to be passed on to consumers and small businesses. Unfortunately, that is unlikely to actually happen. Because offering multiple networks will incur additional costs, that money will have to come from somewhere, and that somewhere is going to come from consumers and small businesses. Many of them, by the way, so small that they're just sole proprietor side hustles in an LLC wrapper. If the CCCA is passed, we'll likely see the elimination or dramatic scaling back of popular card rewards like points, miles, and cash back, and a reduction in the availability of credit lines overall. Patrice writes, quote, the savings to small businesses from the proposed regulations are unlikely to outweigh the losses they will incur. Those negative outcomes will erode competitiveness for small businesses, especially compared to larger businesses, which will be better suited to handle the proposed changes in the bill, end quote. You can read Patrice's full article, quote, How the Credit Card Competition Act Could Disadvantage Small Businesses at IWF.org. And now a welcome update from the indefatigable stat hounds at Our World in Data. If you've been reading about the health of pregnant women in recent years, you may have heard that maternal deaths have been significantly increasing in the United States. National Public Radio, for example, broadcast a report last year that included the claim that, quote, the number of people dying in the U.S. from pregnancy-related causes has more than doubled in the past 20 years. That sounds like an alarming trend indeed. Researchers have recently shown, however, that that rise does not represent an actual increase in the number of women dying in childbirth, fortunately. Rather, it's the result of a change in measurement that was gradually introduced to the U.S. between 2003 and 2017. First, though, the background. Maternal mortality refers to the deaths of mothers from pregnancy, childbirth, abortion, or related causes. Rates are measured as the number of maternal deaths per 100,000 women in the population. The U.S. maternal mortality rate, along with that of other developed countries, had fallen steeply since the mid-20th century, but in the last two decades, the rate appears to have risen in the U.S. Between 23 and 2017, it's more than doubled, from 0.4 to 0.8 deaths per 100,000 women. In other advanced economies like France, Canada, and the U.K., the rates have continued to be stable or fall. The major reason for this is the guidelines from a widely used medical handbook called the International Classification of Diseases, or ICD. The 10th version of the ICD, first published back in 1994, suggested more aggressive data collection regarding maternal health statistics. Worried that maternal deaths had previously been undercounted, the ICD encourages medical officials to change death certificate procedures so that such documents record not just whether a woman was pregnant when she died, but whether she had given birth up to a year previous to her death. Individual states adopted this guidance gradually so that by 2017, every state required this additional information. The problem is that they didn't change how the number was aggregated into national figures, which means that the old stats captured mostly women who died while giving birth or days afterwards, but now included deaths of women who died, possibly from unrelated causes, months afterward. This is obviously an apple and oranges comparison that was guaranteed to lead to confusion. Both the apparent rising death rates and the divergence from international trends is an artifact of our new and different statistical methods, not an actual increase in pregnant mothers dying. Cheers to the researchers who investigated the story and produced the welcome explanation. Those are the headlines for episode 73. Now we'll move on to our interview with Claire Kittle Dixon of Talent Market. Now I'd like to welcome to the show Claire Kittle, Executive Director at Talent Market. Welcome to Free the Economy, Claire.
It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Now, just to get us started, can you give us a quick backstory, the elevator pitch on your organization, Talent Market, and what its mission is?
You bet. So we are a 15-year-old nonprofit, and we focus on helping liberty-oriented nonprofits find the talent they need. I love your mug, by the way.
Thank you. I'm always representing the panda.
So we've been around 15 years. We've placed more than 1,200 individuals in the liberty movement, and we've worked with more than 250 liberty-oriented nonprofits. So our job is to help the liberty movement find talent.
All right. That's excellent. Now, when, you know, we often talk about employment and the workforce and jobs and job trends and all that kind of stuff here on the show. And so because, you know, we think all that news is important. But we also like to ask our guests often about their own employment journey, where they came from, how their career progressed, and and how did you get into this world, both in sort of like talent and staffing, but then also in like the kind of advocacy world as well?
Yeah. This could take the rest of the time we have, so I'll try to be brief. So I was toiling away in the private sector. And I was actually doing recruiting, strangely enough, and I had accidentally slipped and tripped and ended up there. But I was, in a sense, living the dream because I was working for myself. I was working from home way before that was the cool thing to do. And I was making good money, but I was completely unfulfilled. It was like making widgets to me. It did nothing for me in terms of fulfillment. At the same time, I started paying the government quarterly tax estimates because I was self-employed. And let me just tell you how much that fired me up, because I realized, what are you doing to earn this, you know, this amount of money? So that, combined with the fact that I wasn't fulfilled, inspired me to sell my company, move to DC, and change the world. I was really just that naive. That's what I did. Packed up and left. All my friends thought I was nuts. I ended up getting a master's in public policy because I thought, I don't have any relevant experience. And if I'm going to come and work in this world, I need to do something to make me relevant. That was a very harebrained plan. And I never recommend to anyone that they just go off and get an MPP, especially someone like me who really isn't probably best suited to be in policy. So anyway, finished up my master's and ended up, I was networking. I was going to like America's Future events. And somebody said, someone I met there said, you should go work for Coke. And I was like, Coca-Cola. Okay. Yeah. And they were like, no, Coke. And that's how clueless I was. So I ended up interviewing and I got a job at the Coke Foundation, where I did leadership and talent development. And I think they hired me because they thought my recruiting background was relevant. That's debatable. I'm just glad they hired me. When I was there, I launched the Coke Associate Program and the Coke Internship Program. And I had a very good, you know, point of view when it comes to hiring and firing and talent development programs and all those good things. Fast forward a few years, someone came to me with the idea to start Talent Market. And I thought it was a brilliant idea. And so that was 15 years ago. And here we are.
All right. That's an exciting journey. and I know we've had plenty of great Coke Associates and Coke interns here at CEI over the years. So, you know, with that background, you said going from the like just sort of like the regular for-profit corporate world and then now this sort of like nonprofit advocacy world. How is that different, recruiting people? Is it mostly the same and different on the edges, or is it like a completely different project?
So the first thing that screams to mind is awareness, or I should say lack of awareness of our world. So I hear from people all the time who say, I had no idea there was this entire liberty movement. You know, they've heard of CEI, AEI, Cato, but just a small group of organizations, and they don't know enough to know they can actually build a career in our world. So when they discover Talent Market and we say, no, look at all these openings and look at all these organizations, a lot of heads explode. So I think lack of awareness that this is a very real career path is probably the biggest difference. And it's also our biggest hurdle in a way, because there are a lot of people who I think are toiling away in the private sector and would love to come and do this kind of work, but they just don't know they can. The upside, though, I think for our world is passion. You know, there's this connection to the mission that we all have. And when you're reviewing applications, let's say for jobs, it's quite clear that this person's passionate and this person is just going through the motions and they've submitted a generic cover letter, or my favorite, an entirely ChatGPT written cover letter with no mention of liberty. So I think I won't say it's easy, but it's easier for us to tell if someone is mission aligned. Whereas if you're working in the private sector, if your company's making widgets, are you even concerned about alignment? Right. It's not even a thing. I imagine it's not really something they even talk about. So are you passionate about widgets? You know, that probably doesn't come up in the interview process. But for us, it's really, really important. So lack of awareness is the big downside. But I think that the passion piece is where we can sort of gain ground in terms of identifying who might be a great fit in our world. And I think those people are more dedicated to our world. It's really hard to come into our space, you know, work with an organization that you're excited about their mission, let's say CEI, and then leave and go back to making widgets, right? I don't know how. I know very few people who do that. And the ones who have done it, I don't think they were ever maybe as dorked out on it as I am. So I think it keeps people in our space with good reason.
Well, yeah, that's the point about, you know, mission alignment and passion for things, I think is interesting, because that certainly does come up in, you know, private sector, you know, recruiting all the time. And, you know, there's any number of jokes and memes and stuff about that, you know, the idea that you would be expected to be passionate about some random company that you maybe don't have any background in. You know, I think there are people who are passionate about some of those things. I don't think you can find that with the vast majority of employees, but some people love the egg sector. Some people love finance. Some people love, you know, sales and being a real estate agent. And so I think those, you know, those possibilities are out there. And but you just have this wider layer of opportunities for, you know, in a sort of market economy, you don't have to like be in love with your employer. Yes. They don't have to be in love with you. Right. You know, it's sort of like the Mad Men response. You know, I need to feel valued. And the boss says, that's what the money is for. Right. It's possible to do that. But you can find passion in any industry if it's there to start with. Now, so you've been doing this for 15 years, and of course doing the other, you know, for-profit stuff before that. How has this the talent recruiting game changed? I feel like you kind of mentioned the ChatGPT written cover letter, so those probably weren't around 15 years ago.
No. We'll start with that. It's a regular thing for me to run cover letters through a detector just to see. And part of it is just for my own curiosity and entertainment. But I will say we work with some clients who don't care much, or actually one of our clients specifically said, please use ChatGPT to write the cover letter for this job application. But that was a client that was really, really focused on technology, and they just wanted to make sure people were utilizing technology. But for the most part, our clients are pretty turned off when someone cannot write even, you know, half their cover letter. Originally, they have to use ChatGPT. So that's kind of it. But it's still playing out. We're still sort of figuring out how do clients respond to it, and how do you even identify it? You know, again, that's something we talk about for a long time, but I won't. But it's very fascinating to me. I'm very interested in seeing how that plays out. So that's one thing. The other thing I'll say, a couple other things. One, there are just more organizations in our space now than there were 15 years ago. And certainly if you go back even before that, if you look at a group like State Policy Network, which is a, you know, capacity building organization that works with state-based think tanks, but also national organizations, you know, when they started, and I think they started in like 86, maybe, there were just like a handful of state-based groups. And now I think there are 64 across all 50 states. And that's just the state-based entities. What about the organizations that are national but based outside of the Beltway? What about the organizations that are based inside the Beltway? So just more and more organizations, which obviously translates to more opportunities for people. So I think just an explosion in opportunities and organizations. And then I won't get too granular, but you know, there are certain kinds of organizations which have sprung up. Litigation firms, for instance. We've all heard of Pacific Legal Foundation. They've been around for a long time, doing amazing work. Just had another win at the Supreme Court. Congratulations, guys. But there are all sorts of other public interest law firms that have sprung up, liberty oriented, obviously, that have sprung up in the last several years. And just it never ceases to amaze me. It seems like there's a new one all the time. And obviously a lot of work to be done. So I'm happy to see more of them spring up. And then a lot of national organizations and state-based groups have developed litigation arms, you know, in-house, which I think is great too. So just another avenue to impact social change. I love, love, love to see that. What else will I tell you about the recruiting game? Evolving pipelines. So again, we can talk about this for the next hour. Where do we get our talent? Well, at some point, it's usually passing through the college. Not everybody goes to college, but most folks who work in our world have received a college degree or at least spent some time on campus. So college campuses are a place where we tend to recruit people. But that the college campus game has changed dramatically just in the time that we've been running Talent Market. So obviously campuses have become more hostile to our ideas. And there are a lot of organizations that used to be really engaged on the campus scene, and they've either completely backed out or they've changed their mission. They're not as active. And so it's an interesting time. A lot of people I know in our space are saying we're doomed because that college pipeline is sort of broken. I'm more optimistic because we're an entrepreneurial bunch and we're going to figure it out. We're also seeing this real pushback, you know, at the collegiate level with people saying, donors saying, alumni saying, we need to refocus on free speech. I think we're going to see more college campuses not being as hostile to these ideas. It's going to take a while, but I'm optimistic that over time we're not doomed. I don't think it's not like the pipeline is going to stop. And there are still independent thinkers out there. I don't care what their professors say. They're still, you know, standing up for what they believe in and sort of rebelling. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I used to run our internship program here at CEI, and I've read a lot of intern resumes and cover letters, interviewed a lot of potential interns, and no one is more excited than a like center right libertarian conservative type student who is on a extremely left wing campus. Like yeah. they are just so excited. Yep. To know that you exist. Yeah. So there's a kind of on some of these campuses where the perceived sort of overall political slant is so far to the left that there's a sort of siege mentality, but there's also kind of esprit de corps among the people who aren't sort of in lockstep with whatever the local chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America is doing that week.
Right. One more thing on that, by the way, and then I'll be quiet about this point, but I have to talk about virtual work and how that has completely changed the recruiting game.
Yeah, because I was going to say that's not even a last 15 years change. That's like just the last 5 years change, really.
Right, right. So obviously when COVID hit, you know, that turned our world upside down. But I will rewind a little bit before COVID. People who read our newsletter know that I was really beating a dead horse about organizations considering virtual hiring again before COVID, because what we had seen was a real difference between an organization hiring for X, same organization over here hiring for X, but this one's willing to hire virtually and this one isn't. And we would just see a stark difference in terms of, you know, quantity and quality of candidates. And so I had so many clients just say it doesn't work, or it didn't work for us, so we're never going to try it again. And, you know, okay, great. We can lead a horse to water, we can't make a drink, right? So then COVID hit and everybody had to go virtual. And so we're seeing some interesting things, obviously, in the post-COVID world. One is we still got clients who brought everyone back to the office and said, we're not changing. This was a blip on the radar. We're not changing the way we do things. I get it. And I respect it. And I, trust me, I see the value in in-person work. My, you know, formative years in my career were spent in an office, and I wouldn't have had it any other way, to be frank with you. But we're seeing a lot of clients who said, you know what, it did work and we're willing to do it. And maybe not for everybody, but for the right candidate, we're willing to do it. So, and those numbers are still, they're even more dramatic, but about you'll see about twice the number of candidates for any given search, ceteris paribus, if you're willing to hire virtually. So, and then there are just candidates who are absolutely unwilling to consider going back to the office. And I'm happy to dig into that because I don't think it's going to change. You know, COVID, it made us work at home, but it also made people sort of reevaluate priorities because people were dying, right? And so everyone sort of stopped and said, wait a minute, am I doing what I love? And by the way, that's brought more people into our world who've always cared about liberty. And now they're like, I'm going to do something about it in a post-COVID world. So it's something that's never going to change. And it has dramatically affected, you know, our clients. And last thing I'll say on this, there are some groups that we work with who are now in cities that were also impacted by COVID fallout, whether that's crime or whatever. And those places are very, very, very difficult to recruit candidates to. If someone's already there, that's one thing. But to get someone to move to a city that has a high crime rate, you know, people just really aren't willing to do it. Certainly not in the way they used to be.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. Before we go on, you mentioned some of the new legal advocacy groups that are out there. And I just want to mention, we just had Janine Yunus, attorney with the New Civil Liberties Alliance, on a couple episodes ago, and they're doing great. I think they celebrated their 5th anniversary recently. Also doing work all the way up there at the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. But back to these shifting sands. I did a sort of little mini rant in my news monologue a couple episodes about this. I feel like every generation complains about new workers joining the workforce. They're always lazy. They're always entitled. They always want to change things. They never want, you know, they want to follow rules. And Gen Z is no different. And the people that work with Gen Z are no different. Lots of complaints to go around. But that doesn't mean that nothing ever really changes. It is possible that some things change, even though the complaints are the same. So this is sort of a two-part question. One, how much time do you guys spend on kind of senior executive people leadership, and how much are your clients looking for more junior people? But do you think the current generation of younger workers, like 18 to 30, Gen Z mostly, do they really have these like unique demands and expectations, or they're just younger workers like every generation of younger workers?
Both, I think. I'll address your first question first. So we do entry level all the way up to executive level. I think about 60% of the roles we fill are really sort of junior to mid, which makes sense that more hiring is done at that lower level and there are fewer executives. But we certainly handle all those sorts of roles and lots of entry and junior level positions. Oh, goodness. How is Gen Z different? I will start with the comment that, you know, if you just sort of read the news about the impact of technology, phones, on social media on this generation, then you're seeing what everybody's seeing. I won't get into that. I've got some strong opinions about social media and what it does to your brain, and it's not positive. But I think that's a very real thing. I'm going to put that aside for a second. There is a huge push in the Gen Z generation to work virtually. Of course there is. They were like born into it, right? Not born into it, but they were, when they were launching their careers, it was a virtual world. And so this idea that they might have to work in an office is foreign to some of them, not to all of them, but to a lot. And I'm really torn on this because, as I said, I'm a huge fan of virtual work, but I think when you are just launching your career, being in an office is it's how you're going to mature. You're going to mature so much faster. You're going to gain so much more context. You're going to be mentored in a different way. So if I had my druthers, and I know some of my teammates who are younger than I am feel very strongly about this, that you know, sort of junior level employees shouldn't be able to work virtually because they just don't have the context to do it. I wouldn't go that far necessarily, but I absolutely respect that opinion. And again, if I had my way, most people who were, you know, just starting their careers would be working virtually. There's one other thing I will say that I've just noticed in the last couple of years, and that is Gen Z and the side hustle. So, and I think this is tied to social media as well, but a lot of Gen Zers have side hustles. So they've got a full-time job and then they've got this side hustle. And among some of them, there's an assumption that they're just going to keep that side hustle no matter what job they apply for. And And they don't necessarily think about how prospective employers are going to respond to that. So I've had some clients say, if your side hustle isn't competing with what we do, and it's obviously not going to interrupt your 40 hours, you know, that you've dedicated to us, I don't care. And I've had other clients say, if you are going to do the side hustle, then you can just keep doing that side hustle or find a job somewhere else because we're not going to hire you. So very different opinions among clients when it comes to side hustles, but side hustles have just exploded. And I think this generation is, it's almost like they don't consider how a prospective employer would look at that. It's very fascinating to me. So that's definitely on my radar.
Well, see, I think there's a sort of, that could impact differentially between the sort of categories of employers we're talking about. Because for me, I would love that idea because, to hire a younger colleague with that kind of like entrepreneurial, energy. So if you're someone who likes, if you like a market economy, if you like economic freedom and you like entrepreneurship, I feel like, the side hustle would be, very useful. If you're working on stuff that's like economic policy wise, that could even like, you could use what you learn from the side hustle in your actual like policy work. Maybe not. I don't know. Maybe if you work for a labor union, maybe they don't want the competition. But I think right? I think in this like the Liberty Movement, that would be like a good qualification actually. Now, so you kind of mentioned this already about people making career changes and people moving for sort of like passion and fulfillment reasons. You know, moving from the widget factory to the like you know Institute for Changing the World. And this is something that comes up a lot when I talk to younger people in Washington, people who are interning, people who are trying to start a career. And a lot of them are very, they're just like I was. They're very like 4.0, getting the best grades, striving, got to like check all the boxes, do all the stuff, do all the activities, and because it's all going on your permanent record. But they're really worried that they need to be in lockstep and do get this job in this year and then move up and in 3 to 5 years and then do that and do that and do that. And if they step off of that trail, they'll just be lost forever and their career will be ruined and they won't have, you know, they'll never get what they want. Yeah. So they're, you know, they think they need to plan for their 30-year anniversary at work today. And so they have a lot of anxiety about not staying on exactly the right path to success. And so one of the things I've told them is that you don't need to be that worried. Right. You can try different things. You can go between, say, sort of like in this world of Washington, D.C., there's people who do things like communications or their policy or they do more politics campaign stuff or they do fundraising or, you know, and it's possible to do one of those things and move back and forth and still move up in your career. And also possible, I think we're saying that it's possible to have a career in the sort of for-profit private sector. And then at some point with those skills you learned, you can apply them to this world of politics and policy and advocacy. And you don't have to start from day one and only be on one very clear track. Is that, is that true?
Yes, but, well, first I want to throw out some thoughts related to the planning your career perfectly. I love that you're telling young people, don't worry that much about it because I say the same thing. And I always compare it to, you know, centralized planning. Does it work? No. So let's not centralize plan your career, however you say that. So back to my story, if you were to create a visual of my career, it would not be linear. It would frankly not even be logical in some ways. I mean, I don't think I did. Well, I did some dumb things. I told you the master's in public policy was dumb, but I was headed in a general direction, but I was always open to what the market might bring. And so if you look at, I think two of the sort of most successful things that I would point to in my career, maybe three, none of them were my idea. They were somebody else's idea who said, Claire, I see this in you and I think you might be good at this. What do you think? So a little bit of a side note, but I've realized I'm great at execution. If you want something done, give it to me, step out of the way, I'm going to get it done. I may not be the most, like, I'm not going to sit in the corner and come up with a grand plan to, you know, change the world. But if you say, here's the part that we need you to do to change the world, I got it. Like, just give me it and then leave me alone because I'm going to get it done. People saw that in me and then said, maybe you should do X, maybe you should do Y. And I took them up on it. If I had been reliant on my own planning, I would be doing something far more mundane and frankly, not as impactful as the work that I think Talent Market does. So let this be a lesson for all the young folks. Don't try to plan it all out. Be open to what the market will bring you and be open to what people who may know you better than you have to say. Because I wouldn't say I'm not self-aware, but there were things that people noticed in terms of my skills that I was so focused on execution, I wasn't paying attention to those things and they saw them and I truly value that. So don't plan out your career unless you want to be a neurosurgeon, in which case let's plan it out. So let's talk about pivoting if you're in the private sector. You can do it and you can do it at any point. 5 years, 10 years, 15, 20, whatever, 30 years into your career, you can pivot and come into this world. But you have to be flexible. And what do I mean by that? I mean, let's start with money. If you have been toiling away in the private sector and you've been killing it financially and you're making 300 grand and now you want to pivot into our world and your skills are, you know, kind of relevant, you have to be open-minded in terms of maybe taking a pay cut to come into our world. And if you don't want to do that, I'm not going to say it's impossible, but it's going to be really, really difficult for you to change sectors entirely and maintain, you know, your financial, you know, maintain your salary. So be flexible in terms of salary, but also level. So I've worked with so many executives who are coming from other sectors who want to just run a think tank now, but their experience is kind of relevant, right? They maybe know how to run an organization. They understand operations. They understand budgeting. They understand management leadership, but they haven't got a clue about this, you know, public policy or advocacy or whatever it is. And for those folks, I'd say probably want to pivot into a role that's not so all encompassing. Maybe you just come in and do an operations role. And then later, maybe you can transition into a CEO role. Anyway, you get the idea. You gotta be flexible if you're gonna pivot. And the more senior you are, the more flexible you have to be if you're gonna pivot into our world. I have to share a quick story with you. There was a candidate I worked with years ago who was a fundraiser for the Ivy Leagues. She was making fantastic money. She had a great job and she wanted to transition into policy. Zero policy experience. And so, but I was, hey, I want to help everybody. If you're passionate about liberty, let's see what we can do. But she was unwilling to change in terms of anything. She wanted to stay at this level. She wanted to stay at the same financial levels, the same sort of director level. And unfortunately, I was unable to help her. And she ended up staying in the private, staying in the academic world. But it was heartbreaking to me because she's the kind of person I could have placed in a heartbeat had she been willing to stay in a fundraising role, right? Mm-hmm. She didn't want to do that. She wanted to change everything. So you really, really have to be, don't try to change everything at once. Changing sectors is big enough, but if you change everything, it's going to be more difficult. And if you're not flexible, it's going to be a real uphill battle.
Well, yeah, I feel like, you know, there's a lot of these like, you know, driven, successful, you know, executive manager types who they have a lot of drive and they know they've been able to make organizations work before, you know, because that's what their career has been about. But going from a senior executive salary to a nonprofit salary is not for everyone. I feel like if you're at the place financially where you're ready to retire and you don't need a salary, yeah, then that's a lot easier. But it's also possible for people to join the donor class.
That's right.
Possible if you are a high income person to generously donate to some of these organizations rather than being their executive director. I'm just going to stick that in there. So there's one other theme that I really want to get to, which I think is, this is kind of like a universal thing that I think is kind of underappreciated about the employment market in general, but probably in this one as well, in that when you are looking for a job, especially if you have unexpectedly lost your previous job, it's easy to feel disempowered and it's easy to feel like the organizations that you're applying to have 100% of the leverage and that you are just a, you know, a leaf in the wind, you know, and you have like no agency, right? And they have all the power. Mm-hmm. And totally understandable. Mm-hmm. I've been in that position myself. Mm-hmm. But as someone who's also tried to hire people, mm-hmm. that can also be very difficult and challenging as well. Yeah. And so I think there's maybe more of a give and take there mm-hmm. than it feels like when you're looking for a job, especially when you really need a job. And I also understand why people don't have tons of sympathy, especially if the people looking for workers are, you know, giant corporations and they're like, oh, well, I'm going to cry a lot of tears for them. But understanding that there is a give and take in there and that the people who are trying to hire are like often between a rock and a hard place themselves because they can't fill roles, I think might kind of get people to not feel so disempowered, right? To realize that if they're a person with some talent and they've got some drive, that they do have something to offer and that it's not quite so one-sided. Have you worked with clients where you feel like they're just like, tearing their hair out, can't find the right person, and that it's like really impacting them, just like with a person trying to find a job?
Yes. Yes. But I'm going to separate those situations into two groups. One is it's what I call the unicorn search. Okay. That's a unicorn. We have clients who sometimes look for unicorns and they're pulling their hair out. And we're saying, okay, but if you just remove the horn as a requirement, you know, and the wings, right? We could probably find somebody. And sometimes it's a, hey, if you are willing to go virtual, we just had this happen with a client and they were like, no, it has to be an office, has to be an office. And we said, please. And they opened it up to virtual and they hired someone virtually and they love the person. Anyway, happens all the time. So if the client is looking for a unicorn, then there's some hair pulling out. But if they listen, and I'm not saying that we have all the answers, but we've been at it for a while. And so we can usually look at a description, look at the salary, look at the requirements and say, this is going to be incredibly difficult and doable, or this is going to be incredibly difficult and I'm not optimistic we're going to be able to help you. So in those cases, if the client is willing to be flexible and listen and, you know, toss this to the side, then typically they're not pulling their hair out. But then the other group is clients who are not looking for a unicorn, but they're just looking for something that we don't have a lot of. And when I say we don't mean talent market, I mean the market doesn't have a lot of. And so yes, it's not always super easy. I will say, and there are about a million things I could add to that, like the organization reputation, if they have got a great reputation, if they're solid financially, if this, if that, you know, all these things matter and candidates do their homework. Not every candidate, but a lot of candidates do their homework. And so if an organization is struggling in any of those ways, even if what they're looking for is realistic, that's going to be an uphill battle for them. But I want to say two things specifically to candidates. One is if you're having a tough time finding a job in our world, don't give up. There's this notion that it'll be so easy to find a job in the nonprofit world because it's not competitive like the private sector. False. Absolutely false. You should come and see how many candidates we have going for any given search. And it's really sad. Sometimes I work with very, very, very talented candidates who've applied for multiple jobs and they haven't landed any and they start getting depressed. And I have to say, it's not you, especially if, you know, they've become a finalist for multiple roles. It's just that they're competing for jobs that where there are dozens and dozens of other really, really good candidates. So don't give up. Don't give up. Second, I will say, depending on who you are, let's just pick on the talent we need most. Let's say you're a fundraiser and let's say you are a very talented fundraiser with a very strong track record of success. And you've got that, you know, very strong intellectual edge where you can go and you can sit down with donors and talk about policy issues and, you know, all that good stuff. If you've got all those things going for you, organizations are going to have to court you truly. And if any organization gets cocky when they're interviewing someone like that, the candidate is theirs to lose, and they probably will lose them. And we see this all the time. And we try to say to our clients, hey, you might want to move kind of quickly on this person because they're a hot commodity. And sometimes the clients don't listen and the candidate gets another job and that's the way it goes. But to be clear, it's not as though the client always has the leverage, because candidates like that, they're always going to have the leverage. It just depends on the person.
Good advice. Go into fundraising.
yes.
So, you know, and we're also, I'm looking at some of these like longer term trends, bigger picture trends about employment in general. And, you know, there's a big debate going on. And it's doesn't necessarily follow the like usual partisan ideological lines about whether in the current year we're in right now, is the economy good? Is the economy not good? Is employment good? Is employment not good? A lot of people have surprising divergent opinions about that. Not to be coy about it, but what I mean is, you know, a lot of Republicans say, oh, well, the economy has to be bad because Biden's in the White House. And a lot of like more left-wing people, not sort of the centrist Democrats, but the left-wing people are also saying the same thing because they don't like the sort of centrist Democratic politics that Biden represents. And so you've got kind of a horseshoe theory where some like right-wing people and very left-wing people are all conspiring to say this is like the worst economy in like history. But we do have low unemployment, and in recent surveys, there's one that came out at the end of last year about the conference board has been tracking since the 80s job satisfaction, just overall job satisfaction. You ask American workers, are you mostly satisfied with your job or not? And that one number has been tracked for a long time, mm-hmm. and it is now the highest it's ever been, going back to 1987. So I feel like that should tell us something. You know, or we can argue about individual policies and what we think would improve it. But in general, we're certainly a lot better off than we were in 2010, right? We're, you know, bottoming out with the Great Recession.
Yeah.
What have you seen? Obviously, your world is a lot more focused than, you know, every worker in America. But what has your coming out of COVID? Have you gotten the sense that, you know, actually things are going pretty good, or people are generally satisfied with their jobs, or they're so ambitious that they're quitting jobs and finding other ones that are even better paying? Like what have you seen like just in the past few years?
Yeah. A little bit of everything, right? Because some people always want to change jobs a little bit of everything. But I will say I am not surprised to hear that people are happier now really than they have been in a long time. And I immediately attribute it to two things. One, that shift I talked about when COVID happened and people sort of stopped and said, let me reevaluate everything. What am I doing? Why am I doing it? You know, I'm working for the man. I don't want to be working for the man. I've got these ideas I value. And never mind that there was this huge power grab by the government, right? So anybody, and so many people reach out to us, and we always ask them, what got you interested in liberty? So many people reach out and say, the COVID lockdowns. That really changed a lot of people's minds about the government, or opened their eyes. They were seeing it, but they wanted to ignore it. And then they were like, okay, I can't ignore it anymore. So that sort of reevaluation of priorities, I think it has to be tied into the satisfaction, because a lot of those folks made changes and now they're happier because they made those changes. But I have to pick on virtual work as the other factor, because there are so many people who were trying to do it all. You know, they have a spouse and an offspring and, you know, a job, and they both, the spouses work outside the home and, you know, trying to just do it all. And when COVID happened and they started working virtually, they were like, oh, I can actually run some laundry during the day. I mean, you get the idea, right? And I think for the people who didn't go back, or they went back, but not full time, right? They went back to work full time, but they're not in the office full time. They are not commuting 2 hours a day, 5 days a week.
Right.
That time matters. And this is why, again, I wish my clients would listen when I talk about virtual work. Even just hybrid, I think, means a lot, although it doesn't mean nearly as much as actual virtual work, because some people are stuck in Albuquerque and they're not moving. So, and if you want to hire them, you got to hire them virtually, unless you want to open up shop in Albuquerque. So I think the virtual work has absolutely led people to a higher happiness quotient, and I'm thrilled with it. I never want that to change. But those are the two things that kind of scream to mind in terms of why people are happier. But I'll also say, we're working with people who came into this world, passionate about liberty, And I feel like all the people we work with are typically pretty happy because, I mean, yes, sometimes they're not, they don't like their boss and they want to change or they want more money or this or that. But even if they have complaints about their job, they don't feel like they're doing something that is meaningless. They always, always, always feel like it is meaningful. And that means a lot to people. And I think that absolutely makes them happier overall.
All right. That's fantastic. Well, Claire, this has been an excellent conversation. Thank you so much. I'm going to give you one last chance to, if you've got any like red hot tips for young people breaking into the whole policy world, give us the red hot tips and then tell us like where we can find you and all these job openings.
Yeah. The red hot tip is connect with Talent Market, talentmarket.org, claire@talentmarket.org. If you connect with us, and what do I mean by that? You can send us your resume. You can sign up for our newsletter. If you send us your resume, we are going to proactively tell you about jobs that match the criteria you tell us about. So you can sit on your couch and these job openings will come to you. How great is that? You can also be proactive and look at our openings list, which if you go to talentmarket.org, you can't miss them. They're going to slap you in the face right there. So you can be proactive and look at our openings. You can wait to hear from us. You can do a little bit of both. I think most people do a little bit of both. We also have a newsletter, comes out monthly, and it has all of our current job openings. So truly, and I don't care if you're just starting in your career or your career, you know, 50 years into it, connect with Talent Market. If you want a job advancing liberty, you would be crazy not to do that. So please, please connect with us. And then the last thing I will say is when you are applying to a job in our world, please, please express your passion in your cover letter. Don't think that so many people outside of our world have had to hide what they believe. And they're so used to that, that when they apply for a job in our world, they think, well, I'm not allowed to talk about my personal philosophy. No, 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 you are. And we encourage you to do it. And the more passionate you are, the more we know that you're aligned with this group and you might be a great fit. So do not be afraid to talk about your love of liberty in your job application if you're applying for a job through Talent Market.
You can mention your Friedrich Hayek tattoo. It's
okay. Yes. Yes.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Claire. And thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
That's our show for this week. This has been episode 73 of Free the Economy. I'm your host, Richard Morrison. Our producer is Ryan Krasinski, and our technical advisor is Ryan Lynch. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week for episode 74.